From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. For a long time, nationality seemed like a baseline, immutable fact. Not now. Globally, war and dislocation have left millions formerly stateless, with no country to claim as their own. At the same time, a booming global market has blossomed for passports, for flexibility, freedom, and less taxes. All it takes is money. Citizenship, for some, has become a convenience, a commodity, and less about nationality or patriotism. This hour on Point, citizenship for sale and the new haves and have-nots. Those who have no place to call their own, no passport, no nationality. Here was the head of the UN High Commission for Refugees, the High Commissioner, Antonio Guterres, talking in July with the Associated Press about the plight of millions of stateless people around the world.
Imagine yourself. You are not here in London. You are in the slums of a city in the developing world. You have no nationality. You have no ID card. You have no access to health services. You cannot send your children to the school. You cannot have property. You cannot have a legal job. You can be harassed by the police and detained indefinitely. It's a question of human dignity, and it is also an enormous amount of suffering.
That is the low end, the stateless end. At the high end, millionaires, billionaires all over the world, there are plenty of people now who will sell them passports to a whole lot of places. Here's an ad from Henley & Partners, the world's maybe leading purveyor of citizenship, of passports.
Why become a resident or citizen of another country? Enjoy visa-free travel and international flexibility. Protect your family. Give your children the best education and safety. Peace of mind. Become a global citizen.
Billionaires, line up here, free as a bird. Become a global citizen with a passport of your dreams. Just put down the money. Joining me now from New York is Atoussa Araxi Abrahamian. She is opinion editor at Al Jazeera America, spent the last few years reporting on the global market for passports, global statelessness, and the changing meaning of citizenship. Her new book is The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. You can find a link, an excerpt, at our website, onpointradio.org. Atoussa, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So there's a high end and a low end, and they're very different worlds that they live in. You're talking about, you and others, talking about millions of people who are now stateless. How does, we get how billionaires can buy passports, though in the course of this hour, I think we're going to hear some pretty eye-popping, ear-popping examples of that. But at the low end, how does statelessness happen, Atoussa? Most people are born, they belong to some country, and that's that.
So statelessness is a pretty complex issue, and it varies region by region. The reasons why people are stateless can vary tremendously. Why don't we start with Syria, since that's been in the news?
Okay.
A lot of Syrian refugees have been leaving Syria, and their children are being born in neighboring countries such as Lebanon. In May, the UN said that 36,000 Syrian babies were born stateless in Lebanon. The reason for this was largely administrative and financial. Maybe their parents didn't have the money to pay the residence fee to be registered in Lebanon. Maybe they didn't want to deal with the Syrian government to ask for documentation. So that's one reason. Then you have other regions such as Myanmar, where an estimated 10% of the total of 10 million stateless people are currently. And they are largely Muslims. They're persecuted a lot. And Myanmar will not accept them as citizens. They won't recognize them. I think they say that they are, technically, they're supposed to be Bangladeshi. And so Myanmar will not accept them as citizens.
And then there are others who just have never been accepted into the whole nation state system post-Westphalia almost, or post the redrawing, let's say, the Middle East. You write a lot in the book about the Bedouin people who live in a number of countries there, Kuwait, the UAE, and more. And when boundaries were laid down and nation states were carved out, they simply weren't invited to the party.
Precisely. Some weren't invited. Some didn't see the need to sign up. You know, if this is a relatively new concept and they've always been living there, why sign up? What's the point? What's the point of a passport? Turns out there's a big point, but they didn't. Nobody could really predict that at the time. Now it's become a very, very important thing to have in these regions.
In the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, they looked at these people and they thought, the Bedouin, and they thought, we don't really want them to be our citizens. They handled this in quite a novel way. What did they do?
They did handle it in a very novel way. So about 10 years ago, the UAE decided we're going to try to deal with this problem that we have of statelessness. The human rights groups were getting on their case. The Bedouin were starting a little bit to ask for representation. And so there were several ways to cope with this. Mothers, I think, can now pass on citizenship to their children. They couldn't before. It only went through patrilineal lines. But the most creative way to deal with this was simply to get them citizenship from another country.
And they bought it from the little Indian Ocean islands of Comoros.
Exactly. It was it's quite a, like I said, a creative solution mediated by a middleman, a French-Syrian person called Bashar Kiwan, who mediated the transaction between the Comoro Islands and some officials in the UAE. And they saw it, each side saw it as a win-win. The Comoros really needed the money, and they were promised $200 million to document some 4,000 families in the UAE. The UAE thinks, great, this is a problem we don't have to deal with anymore, and we don't have to give them our own citizenship either, which is very expensive. If you think that Sweden or Denmark is generous with state benefits, look at the UAE. I mean, it's a great citizenship to have. Very few people have it. And as a result, it's unclear exactly how many of the Bedouin obtained Comoros citizenship, but I think it's in the tens of thousands. This whole thing has been very, very murky and kept under wraps. But what happened was that now you have people who are citizens of a country that maybe they'd never even heard of before becoming citizens of it.
And some sent there, it's kind of a penal colony. I guess you were there, and there's this remarkable description, very poor Comoros, almost nothing. They do have this ylang-ylang flower used in high-end perfumes. You described driving in from the airport. They don't have a functional waste collection system there, but they do have these wonderfully fragrant flowers. You describe a tropical climate, this unique olfactory experience, one part hot garbage, the other part Chanel No. 5. But for the Bedouin, who were sort of pushed into this citizenship, now they have a state, but it's not really a favor they were done.
Not necessarily. I mean, on one hand, you know, they're documented, and I think that for the Emirates framed this as a middle ground between being stateless and being Emirati. So the idea was you take the Comoros citizenship, and then now that you're documented, you can then go on to apply for Emirati citizenship. Unclear if that many people actually got it in the end. Again, this whole thing's been very, very murky. But it's also a disservice because the one thing that stateless people have going for them, if they are in a country and established in a country, even though the country won't claim them, is that without a passport and without documentation, they can't be deported. Now, if you're considered a legal foreigner or a citizen of the Comoro Islands, you can be deported. This happened, in my knowledge, only to one person, one activist for stateless people's rights, who was given a Comoros passport. He says he was pressured into taking it. He said he was not able to renew the license plates on his car and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he got the passport. His family did too. And a little while later, he was thrown in jail and basically said that they told him that you either spend your life in jail or you take off. And they gave him a pick of places to go, and the Comoros was not one of them. So he landed in Thailand, and ultimately things worked out okay. He's now in Canada. He got asylum in Canada. But it just illustrates how insidious these types of schemes can be.
There at the bottom of this pile, at the top, you describe a world where all kinds of countries are now opening up their citizenship for sale. Some, it's really just a cash transaction. Others, I guess the United States included, you might say, if you make a certain kind of investment at a certain volume of money, in you come. How active is that market?
In the United States, it's been very successful over the past year. There is a quota of 10,000 visas, I think, that are given out through this program called EB-5. 85% of the demand came from China, and last year the U.S. met its quota. So it's been very, very popular. The other countries, some of them are just starting off. Malta started to offer up citizenship to investors a couple years ago. Seems to be going quite well for them. The Caribbean, this just has a booming citizenship business. In St. Kitts and Nevis, I think a couple years ago, something like 25% of their GDP came from just the administrative fees from the passport program. In St. Kitts and Nevis, they will sell citizenship for a cash donation of $250,000. You can also buy a condo or a share of a bigger property for $400,000, and that qualifies you for a passport. So buy a vacation house, get a passport thrown in for free. It's a pretty good deal.
We'll talk more about how that works and why people do it. But the net result of it is you've got a sort of wonderfully nuanced thesis here on what is happening with the idea of citizenship sort of melting away at the edges in the era of globalization.
Absolutely. And I think for a lot of people, citizenship still means a lot. People feel, obviously, Mr. Trump last night definitely showed that he feels very, very much American. And a lot of Americans do, and a lot of Emiratis do, and a lot of French people do. That said, like you said, around the edges, we're seeing a disconnect between the person and the place, the person and their passport, where they are from on paper and where they feel they are from. I think this is definitely being exacerbated by globalization.
And a kind of really plutocracy of people who may have many citizenships and using different ones for different reasons, tax reasons or the kind of visa requirements that they will or will not face with those, to flee to safety, to just have many homes and easy access. There's a kind of global elite beyond the normal citizenship boundaries.
Absolutely. Yep. The reality is that if you have enough money, borders don't have to exist as much for you as they do for other people. And to quote a tax lawyer whose paper I was reading while I was writing the book, he says, "While stateless people wander the globe seeking a home, stateless income is welcome everywhere." And here he's referring to corporate profits that aren't taxed by any country because they're able to, through various loopholes, end up in havens.
It's a new world. And on this Veterans Day, when we remember those who have fought for nations, you have a lot of others who have none or, with enough money, may have many. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about people without countries and people with lots of countries, statelessness, citizenship for sale, and the changing meaning of citizenship when it's often not about homeland anymore. Atoussa Araxi Abrahamian is my guest. She's author of the new book, very interesting book, called The Cosmopolites, as in Global Citizen, The Coming of the Global Citizen. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. I wonder if you've seen these new extremes. People with no country, no citizenship. People with multiple countries, a fistful of passports. Is this the new rich-poor divide? The rich get global entree, can buy passports, membership, citizenship all over. The poor and displaced have to fight to come ashore, to belong anywhere. And should citizenship mean more than what you can pay for a passport? Last year, the Los Angeles Times editorial board published a series of editorials called The 21st Century Citizen, and they asked people, what does citizenship mean to you? Here's Brooke Brewer, a 22-year-old music student.
Citizenship to me is being a part of a nation, a legal member of a nation, and it's supposed to get me the protection of the government, the support of the government, and a place where I can live and thrive successfully.
If you don't have that and you're low on the ladder these days, life can be pretty tough. Here's a BBC interview with one of the Bedouin that Atoussa writes about, talking with BBC in Kuwait.
I sometimes don't have enough money to buy the kids milk. It costs about $7.50 a bottle, and I have to borrow the money. So when I say that we live below the poverty line, I'm not exaggerating. And we now know that our kids' future is lost. Their future is unknown. It's a dark future. We know that after high school, no university will accept them, and there is no job for them.
Stateless and in trouble. On the other hand, if you're loaded, there are lots of options for you these days, and plenty of people who will go out and help you find citizenship, maybe all over the place. Here's a 2014 ad, again, from Henley & Partners. This is this firm, big purveyor of passports. Here are clients of the firm in this promotional tape talking about why they need more citizenships.
Truly the ultimate symbol of freedom.
Yes, being free.
The ability to live where you want, travel where you want, raise your kids where you want, and not subject your family to the fate of where you happen to be born. You actually get to choose.
Just choose, free as a bird, anywhere you like, a kind of global citizenship. Atusa, please stand by in New York. Kim Gittleson with the BBC joins us in just a moment. But a call or two here first. First, Maggie in Boston. Maggie, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you know?
I called in because this is a topic that's really important to me. I took out American citizenship about more than 20 years ago. I'm a Canadian citizen.
Okay.
I also have citizenship in St. Lucia, which I did not purchase. I lived a long time in the Caribbean, and I intended to stay in St. Lucia. I'm also a graduate of the University of the West Indies.
Okay.
And I think that it's a very good thing that people don't have one single national identity. Thinking about taking out a different citizenship made me question my feelings about being a Canadian, and that it was just a matter of entitlement that I happened to have been born in a neutral power that was comfortable economically and a good place to identify with anywhere in the world. And I think that a lot of the things you're talking about are about global inequities, where we have people who are stateless because of where they were born or what happened in the place where they were born. And I've worked in Haiti for quite a while, and also traveled in and out of the occupied territories in Israel, where I worked for about a year and a half. Those are both examples of people that are both escaping and are stateless. And at the other end, you have people that do move around and are wealthy that you're talking about. And I think what we need is global government, and all of this illustrates that, rather than our feeling some sort of allegiance like to a physical territory as though it were a monogamous relationship. I think if we have affinity to different places, that's a very positive thing. And with that affinity, we have some responsibility to make that place work well, whether it's the American government
yes.
or the difference between Cambridge and Boston. And if I could come back in 300 years to this world, I think if human beings were still around, that the difference between the United States and some other state would be like the difference between Boston and Cambridge, and that it would be a matter of administratively managing the area and not people having wars over the boundaries and feeling some sort of allegiance and patriotism, which I see as potentially very negative things.
Maggie, I'm very glad that you called. I mean, we feel this tension, especially here we are on Veterans Day. Atusa, this speaks to something that you pay a lot of attention to in the book, and I think you felt yourself that there's some aspiration to get beyond this long, centuries-long era now of heavy focus on the boundaries of nations and membership there. I mean, you've got citizenship, I think, in Switzerland, Canada, Iran, and the idea of being a global citizen, not so tied to particular nation, is something I believe you understand the appeal of, Atusa.
I think it's a very important thing to keep in mind today, especially as we are facing problems of global magnitude. Take climate change, for instance. This isn't a problem that any individual country can solve on its own. So we have to think beyond borders. We have to think about people we possibly have never met before and will never meet before, and think about how our actions affect them. I think that's a pretty fundamental baseline definition of being a cosmopolitan, or being a global citizen. What Maggie brought up, this idea of world government, is very, very pertinent today on Veterans Day. In The Cosmopolites, I tell the story of a World War II veteran named Gary Davis. He was a pilot for the U.S. He fought in the war. He was also a Broadway actor, so a bit of a ham. Mm-hmm. And after the war, he was so disgusted by the ways that nations treat each other, and the way what people were compelled to do to each other as a result of war.
Millions dying in the name of a particular flag or patch of earth.
Yeah, this disgusted him, and he decided to renounce all allegiance to any country. I mean, he only had U.S. citizenship. He gave up his U.S. citizenship and declared himself a citizen of the world. And his whole life, he died a couple of years ago, but his whole life he spent advocating for world citizenship, and very much along the lines that Maggie was speaking.
On the other hand, nations have been associated with certain values, and at their best, nations create a place where, you know, people take responsibility for somewhere instead of nowhere. If you've got 16 passports and go, it could be just a parasitic life. Let somebody else really dig in and take responsibility for this locale. If I don't like it, I'll move on.
Yeah, I think you're right. And tax havens are a really good illustration of that. we do need countries to have some sort of framework for redistribution, for caring about communities, for giving people rights and giving people the right to defend their rights. Hannah Arendt, writing generations ago, described citizenship as the right to have rights. So when you are one of these people who has multiple passports and can choose where they live, the question is, where do you pay taxes? Who do you care about? Who is your community? And how are you going to be engaged with anyone other than yourself and your immediate family?
And if a conflict comes, who fights for you? Of course, Gary Davis would say, let's not have those nations fighting nations. Atoussa Araxi Abrahamian, please stand by, author of The Cosmopolites. Kim Gittleson joins us right now from New York, a business reporter for the BBC. She's right now on leave as a Knight Bagot Fellow at the Columbia Business School. Kim Gittleson, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Hey, Atoussa.
You've reported...
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You've reported quite a bit on this market for citizenship, for passports. Give us a sense of the range of countries now ready to offer a passport for a price.
You know, it's funny. One of your callers mentioned sort of this monogamous relationship, and I'm looking at a list of passports or a price, and it's almost like a dating menu. So it's important to distinguish between two types. There are the types of passports you can just go and buy, and there are the types that sort of require a residency or some sort of purchase of property. Mm-hmm. The ones that you can just buy, the cheapest by far is Dominica. If you have $100,000 lying around, all you have to do is put it down. Don't even have to go into the country and you get a passport. Followed by that, we have Grenada, Antigua and Barbuda, St. Kitts and Nevis, and then two European countries, Malta and Cyprus. And those are the two that are most highly prized. Obviously, if you can get citizenship there, you can work anywhere within the European Union. So it's a very attractive proposition.
Why would somebody want to have citizenship or a passport from Dominica, Grenada, Antigua? Why?
You know, you still can travel visa-free to quite a few countries with those passports, and that's partially the appeal. There's also this idea, sort of, you can have a starter home. You can have a starter passport, I guess, and you can kind of work your way up to a better passport. So you might start with that one and then move along the, I don't know, range of options available to you.
Who is buying most of these passports? We've heard a lot about this Swiss outfit that will sell them to you. Who's the market?
So the IMF recently came out with a report. It's a majority, unsurprisingly, of Chinese investors, followed by the Russians, and then quite a few people from the Middle East seem to be the main purchasers of these. Obviously, you have to have quite a bit of wealth to engage in this in the first place. So there is a certain requirement for that. And there even are some websites. There's one called Golden Visa Europe that will sell passports to wealthy Americans who want to move to Europe as well.
You talked with this guy, Christian Kalin, who's at Henley & Partners. You quote him in your piece for the BBC saying, just like you diversify an investment portfolio, you want to diversify your passport portfolio. What does he mean?
Honestly, it's a crazy idea, right? It's like when you're diversifying your investments, is you're spreading out risk. And the idea is if you have multiple passports, maybe your life is a little less risky. If there's conflict where you live, you can move to someplace else. Christian's a pretty interesting fellow. Bloomberg recently called him the passport king. He really created this market. He worked with St. Kitts in the 1980s to initially create the sort of first citizenship for sale program, the first passport for sale program. And he's kind of the guy who's grown the industry, although now there are many, many more players.
Of course, and Malta, Cyprus, as you say in there, it's sometimes controversial. Here's a little bit from the Foreign Affairs Minister of Malta, George Vela, telling CNN why about the reasoning behind Malta's decision to put up Maltese citizenship for sale.
The thinking was trying to attract a certain individuals who have got capital, who would come to Malta, who would invest in Malta, and who would help with the economy.
And of course, through that, they have access to all the EU. Maltese didn't necessarily like it. CNN here talking with Maltese citizens about misgivings about selling their passports.
You're supposed to deserve the citizenships to prove yourself or something like Americans do, like a lot of other countries. But to sell me the passport, outrageous, outrageous.
No, I'm definitely against the selling of passports.
Why?
Because passports are not commodities, you can sell.
You're supposed to deserve a citizenship, one Maltese citizen saying there, and another saying passports are not commodities. Atoussa, what about the pushback here? Is this just, are we just melting into a new era, or is the power of money at the top just rolling over this oppositional view that we heard from a couple of these Maltese citizens? Or does, you know, money talks and passports are in hand?
Money talks, passports are in hand. Countries, small countries need money and rich people are happy to spend it. So I don't think this is going away any soon. The pushback exists for sure. I got to say, I went to Malta. I spoke with a number of people and not everybody was against it. Some people were quite pragmatic and they said, you know, it's a small number of people. They're not really going to interfere with our politics, with our lives, and it's money for the country. So that's actually kind of a good thing. Whether or not you have a moral opposition to it is a different question entirely. And I think a lot of people are shocked by the fact that you could, in fact, sell your citizenship.
Put your credit card down, and you too can be a citizen. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Brian, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Right on the border of the U.S., you have a country called Canada that has a history since it was inaugurated of being a lot less strict about passport and citizenship than America has and most other countries in the world. And at least as a high school student, that helped me understand how recent a thing citizenship and national sovereignty is. It's only 500 years old since the Treaty of Westphalia. It's not any older than that, and it's not going to endure much longer, in my opinion. I'll give you some examples, if you like.
Okay.
First of all, when the British Empire was dominant, and even until the 1960s, if you had been born in any country that was part of the old British Empire that, well, never set on it a century ago, you could set up shop in any of those Commonwealth countries, and you were pretty much in like stink. You had maybe to sit around for a couple of years before you got full citizenship, but you were unquestioned when you crossed any of those old imperial mm-hmm. borders.
Mm-hmm.
And that tradition persists in a lot of ways in Canada. Under the reign of Prime Minister Trudeau the First, Vietnam War was raging over in Asia, and we were very, very easy about anybody who was a war resister. We didn't give them citizen instantly, but we gave them refuge, and mm-hmm. over a couple of years, maybe they made family ties here, they became citizens by the 1970s.
Americans and who came north, yeah.
And most recently, because Quebec is the last remnant of the old French Empire in North America anyway, our language, French and English, but mostly French, mm-hmm. is really, really important politically. And so Quebec's government, which is only the status of a state, it isn't a country of its own, like an American state, they have negotiated that they have the right to choose who gets admitted on the pathway to citizenship here.
Why do you think the idea of nationality is likely to dissolve? I think you said, Brian. Why?
Well, just for some of the reasons I've given you. Mm-hmm. For example, for Quebec, the priority is preserving a language. And that is something that they have no alternative but to look outside because for cultural and religious reasons, Quebec isn't reproducing its population the way it used to.
Mm-hmm.
Canada is a gigantic space with lots of resources but nobody to work on them. That's another driver. That is non-political, not monetary, but we just desperately need people and we'll take them if they have something to offer that makes them a qualified candidate to become a citizen.
Brian, I appreciate your call from Montreal. I mean, Atusa, what about this idea of nationality as not a freeing thing, but a kind of cage that over some centuries we've fallen into?
Nationality can be considered a cage if you don't want the one you happen to be born with. When you speak of it as a cage, I think we also have to acknowledge that you don't choose where you're born, you don't choose who your parents are, and most people don't choose their nationality. So buying and selling of it, citizenship, is a departure from this age-old idea. On the subject of cages, it's worth noting that over the past few years, a lot more Americans are renouncing their U.S. citizenship. Why are they doing this? Largely for tax reasons, and not necessarily to save money. They just don't want to deal with the IRS. When you're a U.S. citizen living abroad, you have to file tax returns every year. It's onerous. It takes time. And there are penalties involved if you screw up. And these Americans who are renouncing their citizenship, and it's several thousand each year for the past few years, they would definitely describe their citizenship as a cage that they want to be free of. Most people don't think of U.S. citizenship as a cage, but some do.
Atusa Araxia Abrahamian, please stand by, author of The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. Kim Gittleson with the BBC, it's great to have you with us as well. Listeners, we're talking about people without countries and people with lots of countries. Citizenship for sale. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about people without countries and people with lots of countries, statelessness, citizenship for sale, and the changing meaning of citizenship when it's often not about homeland. Atusia Araxa Abrahamian is with us, author of the new book, The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. And Kim Gittleson is here, business reporter for the BBC, now at the Columbia Business School on a fellowship for a year. Lots of callers for the two of you. Sam in Chesapeake, Virginia. Sam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
What an interesting topic. I'm so glad I can find some people to relate to about this. I feel very much stateless.
Why?
I was born in America, but at the age of three, I moved to China, and I lived there for 10 years. So I grew up my whole childhood, all my memories in a different country.
Yep.
I knew I didn't belong to China, but also moving back, I knew I didn't belong to America either. Even though my passport says America, I feel very much a man without a country.
So what's your wish, Sam?
One more time?
What is your wish, then?
My wish is for a globalization, for people to not find their identity in their country that they were born in. I was just wondering, what are people who feel like this supposed to do? How are we supposed to implement change like this?
Atusa, speak to Sam. This theme runs through your book, some people who desperately need citizenship somewhere and others who feel outside or apart or alienated from the whole system. Where does Sam turn? Or we're still in the Westphalia, great Westphalian era.
Sam, I can empathize with how you feel. I feel the same way, too. I have three citizenships. I don't feel particularly bound to either of them. Where do we go from here? I wish I could tell you. I don't think that we're going to see a world passport anytime soon. I do think that people are starting to realize that there is more to people's identity than their nationality and where they're born. And certainly the refugee crisis and more broadly the global problems that we're dealing with now are making people think twice about whether we really should relate ourselves to just one country and whether our world is organized in a way that still makes sense for the 21st century.
If one's affiliation was not a national affiliation, what would the options be, Atusa? I remember when the Internet was young, people talking about sort of Internet tribes who might see one another as more kin than their own countrymen or women.
I don't think we've come up with a great answer. One answer, which certainly isn't that great, is the Islamic State. The Islamic State is advocating for a caliphate that is not drawn on existing state lines. So you could say a religious conception could be one way to think about it.
But if they stick around long enough, maybe they'll start issuing passports.
I think they have. And a very interesting thing about the Islamic State is that if you go on YouTube, you can find videos of ISIS fighters burning their British or French passports.
In part because didn't the UK and France say, if you go to fight for ISIS, we revoke your passport? And so they were kind of saying, who cares, we don't want it anyway?
I'm not sure if it was an immediate reaction to this legislation that was passed in the UK, but certainly they are renouncing, you know, the West and everything it stands for.
Kim Gittleson, it's interesting to hear that there's Sam who's ready to give up citizenship, where you were covering people willing to pay a lot for it. Why is it worth so much, let's say, to a citizen of China or Russia to have a passport in the Caribbean?
You know, again, I think it's the sort of visa-free travel component. Also, a couple of years ago, we at the BBC spoke to a Chinese student who was studying in Seattle, and her parents had engaged in the EB-5 program in the U.S., in which you can invest $500,000 in a real estate project, and if you create 10 jobs, you get a green card. And her parents had essentially bought her a green card so that when she was done studying, she could stay in the U.S. and not worry about whether or not she would have to leave within a few months of her graduation date.
Of course, we've heard a lot about Chinese trying to get money out as the Chinese economy got worse, about the whole anti-corruption campaign there, and some people who wanted to not be in the country because they might be vulnerable to that, about China wanting to come after them in the States, but then being protected by their American status. So there's a kind of, safe house angle to this, Kim?
For sure. It's a safe asset. It's the same thing in Canada. I mean, it was interesting to hear a Canadian caller. Part of the reason we've seen more outflows of money to these programs in St. Kitts and Antigua is that Canada used to offer a citizenship by investment program, and it was one of the most popular ones, but they did away with it in 2014. And as a result, these other programs became more popular because there weren't as many avenues that you could go to get this visa-free travel, this sort of safe haven status for a lot of your investments.
Let's go to Fred in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Fred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. For a long time now, I've thought that, you know, we would tend to become, you know, citizens of the planet. I didn't expect to see it so soon, actually, and I think it's a good thing. I would like to see some people from Northern Europe and the United States and have some influence over what's happening in the jungles of Brazil. And other places that are having problems, it'll sputter and cough and everything, and there'll be problems here and there, and there'll obviously be some people with criminal minds who can take advantage of it, and they'll their procedures will have to be dealt with. But I've for a long time felt that I was more or less involved with the entire planet, and I think, you know, we've started, and I think. We're going down a good path, maybe become a rough path, but at least I think we're going down the right path.
Fred, I appreciate your call. I mean, Atusa, in a way, sitting in the United States is a privileged bench from which to watch this. On the other hand, if you're in an inflatable boat crossing from Turkey to Greece and you're Syrian and maybe your kids don't even have nationality and you're trying to get into Europe, this whole idea of the easy global citizenship, you know, up against a fence in Hungary or somewhere could look like a joke. It's cold and difficult.
The two extremes with the millionaires buying passports and refugees doing everything they can to get somewhere safe really highlights the structural inequalities in the laws of individual countries who decide who to let in and who to keep out. Last night in the debate, Marco Rubio said, as a sovereign country, we can control who comes in, when they come and how they come. And he gets it. I mean, it's up to sovereign countries to decide who they let in and who they keep out. And we speak a lot about income inequality these days, but we should also be looking at legal inequality and inequality in immigration policies.
Kim, when you spoke with those who are taking advantage of this market in passports, many of whom have a considerable assets, some really rich, I mean, are they looking down their nose at citizenship now as old-fashioned, kind of tut-tut, that's so old-fashioned or puny? I'm a global citizen. I've got 6 passports. I go where I like.
You know, I think it's interesting, this idea of multiple citizenship or dual citizenship. For a long time, it was something that was discouraged. Most nations didn't allow you to have multiple citizenships. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt said multiple nationality was a self-evident absurdity. So it's only recently that you could even be engaging in this process. And I think for many people, it's not really changing their fundamental identity of where they sort of say they're from, but it's really just a risk hedge. It's not like they get a passport to Malta and they say, okay, I feel Maltese. It's really just an insurance hedge, honestly.
But let's listen one more time to the way Henley and Partners are selling this. I mean, it sounds like more than a hedge. They want to, hey, you got money? Come on. Let's listen one more time. This is about the beauty of having more than one citizenship.
Truly the ultimate symbol of freedom.
Yes, being free.
The ability to live where you want, travel where you want, raise your kids where you want, and not subject your family to the fate of where you happen to be born. You actually get to choose.
Well, I mean, that sounds like I don't want to be bothered with all your little national problems. I'm a global super rich. Kurt in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Kurt, you're on the air.
I need some clarity here. On the one hand, we're talking about sort of a generalized philosophical idea that global citizenship is a good and a beautiful thing to supplant national sovereignty and so forth.
Well, I don't know if we are. That's out there.
We're talking about about the very rich people who absolutely require a national sovereignty system in order to evade and avoid the claims of any nation state, such as the violation of financial laws, environmental regulations. They can be a citizen someplace else and require extradition, which would probably never happen. So these are two opposing approaches to this issue of citizenship.
Yeah, and maybe more than two, Kurt. The complexity of what's emerging here is, I think, what's interesting. I mean, Atusa, I think Kurt's quite right. On the one hand, if you have a lot, you may want the resources of a nation to protect that. On the other hand, if you can have, and you'll depend on that, maybe lean on that, but if you've got multiple passports, when the heat is on you and your fortune in particular, you may just flit off.
Sure, it's an a la carte approach to citizenship and residence. You pick and choose.
I'm not sure why the world's becoming more amenable to that, Kim.
I mean, I think it's also worth noting there are some companies who, or there are some, not companies, gosh, that's a Freudian slip there. There are some countries that have done away with these programs. I mentioned Canada, mm-hmm. but Ireland also had a program by which you could get citizenship by investing in real estate in the country. And they did away with it because they found out, honestly, there wasn't an economic benefit. Belize got in trouble, honestly, because you could buy passports so easily. And so many people were taking advantage of that to launder money and escape criminal charges elsewhere that they were forced to suspend it in the wake of 2001. So it's not something, it's not a sort of inevitable path forward where these are just going to grow and grow. I think there are some serious questions about whether or not they can be sustainable in the long term.
We're talking about statelessness and citizenship for sale, people with multiple passports. Jim in Hammond, Louisiana. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is about the legal ramifications. You know, when you're in a country and you have some kind of issue happen, whether illegal or medical or whatever, sometimes you want a nation state to back you up and help you out. And how does that work out when you have multiple passports?
That's a good question. I mean, Atusa, who are you going to call when it hits the fan? Not St. Kitts, I don't think.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on the countries, I guess. If you ask me, if I got into trouble somewhere, who would I call? Probably the Swiss. They're pretty reliable. Canada's not so bad either. it really depends. It depends on your, as Henley puts it, your passport portfolio, if you are lucky enough to have one.
But, Kim, if somebody has multiple passports and they get in trouble, and one of those passports is American, let's say, is the U.S. government as obligated and committed to supporting them when they've got four other passports in their you know, Yves Saint Laurent bag?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a U.S. passport, you have a U.S. passport. I think it's interesting in certain countries. I mean, Russia has a very complicated relationship with its dual citizens. You have to declare your foreign nationality in Russia, and there are some sort of legal ramifications to that if you are also a Russian citizen. You can't call on your U.S. passport in some instances. So I think there are factors to consider. I mean, it's also interesting. Henley does a ranking of these residency visas, and one of the factors that they consider when they're sort of saying where the best residency program is or the best passport to buy is sort of what you get for it, not just in terms of, you know, tax avoidance, for instance, but whether or not there are some sort of safety protections that go along with the passport.
Shopping for that citizenship. Rob in Omaha, Nebraska. Rob, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
A lot of talk about money. Wonder about from the heart. Nationality has to come from the heart. I'm a citizen of Canada. I've been in the U.S. 14 years. Mm-hmm. Can't vote in Canada. Can't vote in the U.S. because I'm on a green card. And it's driving me nuts. I need to participate in the political process, and I want to desperately. And that's moving me slowly towards U.S. citizenship thoughts of. It's got to come from the heart.
And your heart needs to be ultimately located and part of some nation, you're saying, Rob.
Exactly. It's democracies are an incredible thing, and if you're not participating in that political process, are you really what do you got at stake? And that's really moving my heart towards U.S. citizenship. Well, reluctantly, but it is.
We get it.
Yeah,
we get it, Robin. I appreciate your call. Atusa, that speaks to me. I mean, when you plant your flag somewhere and then, in the ideal anyway, you work to make that a better place. The idea of making the whole world a better place is kind of bigger than I can imagine. I mean, it's a great idea, but who's responsible for any particular piece of it, any particular, let's say, democracy?
You're right. You got to start somewhere. Do you need to be a citizen of that place to begin? I don't think so. New York City.
What about voting, for example?
Yeah, well, I think it would be great if people, long-term residents, could vote. New York City a few months ago said that they were considering an initiative to let non-U.S. citizens who were residents in New York City to vote in local elections. That's a great start. And as one of these people, I would love to vote locally.
Kim, is it passé to only have one passport in certain circles now?
I think you could make the argument for that. I just wanted to respond. My father is also Canadian and lived here for 20 years before he eventually renounced his Canadian citizenship. And it was about voting. He felt like he wanted to participate in the process, and it finally pushed him over the edge. And I identify with the idea that you're not really a part of some place unless you can participate in its political process. But I think it's accurate to say that for a not insignificant portion of the super rich, you know, multiple passports are becoming something that's quite regular. You have multiple passports like an investment portfolio, as Christian said.
The world changing and some of it blurring right along with it. Kim Gittleson with the BBC, thank you very much for being with us today, Kim.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Atoussa Araxia Abrahamian, her new book is The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. Atoussa, thank you very much for opening up our insight into all this. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the book and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was a great discussion.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. Happy Veterans Day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.